the Black experience is not, it's not a single story, right? So my folks are from the Caribbean, but now that I live in Mississippi, there's a very different kind of story that's being told here in Mississippi. Yeah. Or like if you're from up north, that's a whole different kind of story, right? And so I think that diverse voices really highlights the fact that like the Black experience is not a single experience.
What's going on, y'all? You have just tuned in to the Black Shutter Podcast. On this show, I invite Black photographers, filmmakers, editors, and creative business folks to discuss their experiences and share their wisdom. You will hear about their work, their challenges, and their inspirations. My name is Idris Taleb Solomon, a creative director, photographer, and filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York. So if you dig photography and you love the culture, keep your mind open and your headphones locked. This is the Black Shutter Podcast. The power of diversity is being able to share your experience while learning from the experiences of others. Sometimes it is a shared experience, but there's always nuance. Language, culture, food, weather, music, all of these factors shape our view of the world. Our guest today believes that Black folks and people of color are multifaceted beings capable of telling a variety of stories. But those stories are limited when compared to a dominant standard that oftentimes is not Black. Her goal is to use her camera to dispel the preconceived notions about the Black body. She is an award-winning photographer, filmmaker, lecturer, and curator. She is an assistant professor of creative multimedia at the University of Mississippi School of Journalism and New Media. Her work focuses on the intersectionality of race, politics, culture, and sexual gender expression to explore the collective human experience. The purpose of her work is to produce visual representations free of an oppressive gaze. Her photographs have been commissioned by the New York Times, Gucci, Vogue, Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, Oprah Magazine, The Atlantic, Apple, New York Magazine, and The Washington Post. Vanessa Charlot, welcome to the Black Shutter Podcast. How you feeling out there, sis?
I'm good, bro. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Just poured another cup of coffee. That's probably going to keep me up longer than okay. I need to be up. But this is the life. This is the life that I designed for myself, right? So, cool. Thank you for joining. Thank you for jumping on and having this conversation with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm real happy to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Vanessa, tell us, where are you calling from?
Well, right now I am actually in Mississippi. I'm in the Delta. But I live in Oxford, Mississippi now. I'm at the University of Mississippi as a professor.
Okay. And what are you a professor of?
Journalism. So I'm teaching photojournalism and digital story production.
Nice.
So I'm working with a lot of student photographers.
Wow.
At the university.
So, all right. That's really interesting. Because, you know, sometimes in order to learn, you need to teach. And when you teach, you learn, right? So I definitely want to get into your experiences as a you know, professor and a working photographer. That's great. So you're in Mississippi now. Where are you from?
I'm from Miami.
Okay.
So I'm a Miami baby through and through.
Okay.
My parents are from the Caribbean.
Oh yeah,
they're Haitian and Dominican.
Okay.
Haitian, you know, and I rep Haiti real hard. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I rep Haiti real, real hard.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, my peoples are from the islands. And that has been like really, really instrumental in shaping my perception of self when it comes to this craft.
Mm. Can you go a little deeper into that? How has like your Caribbean background, you know, shaped you?
Well, yeah, I mean, specifically being Haitian, we're just a very proud people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always repping 1804.
Mm-hmm.
We're one of the most Africanized islands in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
We hold true to a lot of our like spiritual practices, cultural things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're coming from an island that is predominantly Black. Mm-hmm. And even though like it's been laced with a lot of disparaging ideas around it, you know, like you still don't lose your sense of self, right? Mm-hmm. So my focus and even my center comes from being a Black woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm very comfortable with like shooting from that lens, telling stories from that lens. Because like I think that there's so many stories that are told about Black folk or people of color that only highlights one aspect of ourselves, and those aspects are typically things that are sensationalized, right?
Yeah.
And so it takes away the fact that we are like these multifaceted beings with so much more happening in our worlds than what everyone else sees and says. And so being from the islands, like I'm aware of that in a very acute way.
Yeah, I mean, Haiti was the first Caribbean country to revolutionize. Right.
Yeah, we the first Black republic.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So you got to imagine the amount of pride that that is just like all over the island, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And like I bring that with me. Right. Like I'm so proud of the work that I do. I'm proud when I'm like in communion with other Black photographers that are unapologetic about our stories. Mm-hmm. Like, I just think it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's important that more of us continue to, you know, speak our voice so that it's not just, you know, the same types of stories, that everybody is able to identify a story that is like bubbling up within them and then put it out into the world. And then we have a diverse range of stories and perspectives.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, look, the Black experience is not... it's not a single story, right? So my folks are from the Caribbean, but now that I live in Mississippi, there's a very different kind of story that's being told here in Mississippi. Yeah. Or like if you're from up north, that's a whole different kind of story, right? And so I think that diverse voices really highlights the fact that like the Black experience is not a single experience.
Absolutely.
Like it's very, very diverse.
Mm-hmm. So how'd you end up in Mississippi from Miami?
Well, the University of Mississippi gave me an offer that I couldn't refuse.
Okay.
But before that, like in February 2021, I'm a veteran. I served the United States Army. Mm. And I have a really close friend of mine that we served together. And his people are from the Delta. And so we were having a conversation. And he shared with me that his grandfather is a former sharecropper. And so I spoke to his grandfather, whose name is Mr. Davenport, Roosevelt Davenport. And so he proceeded to tell me that he still lives on the Quito Plantation in Morgan City in the Mississippi Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I was one, flabbergasted that there's still... Black folk that live on the plantation.
Wow.
And like, you know, I was also interested in like this story about the Great Migration, right? So you hear about a lot of Black folk who left the South in the 1950s looking for a better life. And out of Mississippi, the first stop was St. Louis. And then people went to, you know, Chicago, New York, just different places. But I was curious about the people who decided to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And how did they navigate creating a life and home and traditions and legacies and whatnot? So I make my way to the Mississippi Delta and I meet this beautiful man, right, who has raised 22 children tilling cotton fields.
Wow.
Yeah.
22.
And his 22. Oof. And his children have all gone off to do amazing things. Like he has one daughter that's a retired colonel in the Air Force, have some that are in law enforcement, or just an array of things. And so me and him began to have a very honest conversation about the courage that it takes to decide to stay in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And because the South is honest. It's very honest in a way that most people are not ready to face when it comes to understanding the story that is the American story. And so I produced this work, and it's still a growing body of work when I'm talking about photographing in the Delta. And the University of Mississippi, again, gives me an offer that I can't refuse. And I knew that I wanted to begin to delve into the roots of this country. And I thought that Mississippi was just an ideal place to do that.
So how did they discover you or find you?
I've been fortunate in that since 2020, my work has been everywhere. Mm-hmm. A lot of the major media houses like New York Times, and I've done work for Vogue and Gucci and The Guardian, et cetera. And so I won the International Women's Media Foundation Award in 2021. And I was in Los Angeles and I was showcasing that work or pieces of that work. And so when they saw that work specifically, they began to get very interested in the work that I'm doing in the Delta, right? Like, a lot of people avoid Mississippi like the plague. And I get it. Like, Mississippi is hard. Mississippi is also very beautiful. And so, that's how that journey that ended me up at the University of Mississippi began.
It's funny you mentioned, like, a lot of people avoid Mississippi. And when you mentioned that you were in Mississippi, I was like, like, why? Right? I'm not trying to knock. I'm not trying to knock the state or the people there. But as a black person, I think we understand, like, that for me, especially being from the Northeast, right, there's certain states that you name and I'm just like, miss me with that. Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's like Mississippi, it's Alabama, you know, like, yeah, a lot of parts of Georgia.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess anywhere outside of Atlanta, pretty much.
Okay.
you know, it just doesn't feel like it's inviting, especially to, especially coming from the Northeast. Now, it's one thing if I was already, like, born into uh-huh. into the South, and I'm already accustomed to, like, how people move, but uh-huh. I'm not. And I think there's right. a lot of things that will rub me the wrong way, a lot of things that will just, like, shock me. Like, even though I may expect it, I would still be shocked when I actually experience it. So it's something about going deep down into the South that just doesn't give me a good vibe. You know what I mean? So it's dope that you're out there making this important work and that this university embraced you and your work, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, like, I get it. When I told my people that I'm coming to Mississippi, they said the same thing, right? Like, my folks in New York was just like, V, why?
Why?
But, you know, like, I had to keep it a buck. I'm like, look, Mississippi is going to give it to you straight, no chaser.
Mm-hmm.
New York is just going to put a little something on it to soften the blow.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But Eric Gardner still happened in New York.
Yep. And so many others.
So, like, it's not, we have this idea that there are certain things that will only happen in certain places, but it's not true. It's just that some places are just better with putting a veneer over it.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, so, like, when it came to Mississippi, like, sure, there are places that are, it's a trip. Like, out here in the landscape, there are crosses in the fields, as you drive by, you already know what's up, right? Like, there are things that's just the reality of what it means to live in Mississippi. At the same time, though, like, Mississippi is the cradle of culture, right? Unless you want to experience good blues, you got to come to the Delta. Or if you want to hear, like, stories about what it really meant to be a freedom fighter in the South, during the Freedom Summers, where you got Fannie Lou Hamer, you got all these people, like, their grandbabies are still here. And so, like, you're getting all of these things that help you understand who you are and why you do this photographic work.
Mm. So how long have you been in Mississippi?
I've been here since August. So I just got here.
Oh, you fresh.
Yeah, I'm fresh. I'm, you know what? And we can talk about Mississippi maybe a year from now, right? I'm super excited now. Mm-hmm. Maybe a year. I might be like, oh, God.
help me. Please help me. Okay, so you're still fresh. Okay.
I'm the new kid on the block.
Well, listen, I hope that your experience stays as fruitful as it's been so far. I mean, you know, I hope it's that well-balanced experience of like,
yeah,
the, you know, ups and downs, everything in between. But you come out with a lot more insight in into who you are and into this place that you're living in, you know, and the people
right
there, you know.
Yeah.
So, wow, Mississippi. We're going to come back to that for sure. We're going to come back to that for sure, because I want to hear how you approach your the academic part with who you are and what's the vibe you're getting from the students, right? So, but before we go down that path, you know, I want to just kind of like hit the rewind button a bit and you know, go back to like your childhood. Like, what was life like for you growing up in a Caribbean household in Miami?
Yes. So I was born and raised in the infamous Little Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like Little Haiti is very much Haitian folk and you know, the hustle and bustle of what it means to be like from an immigrant family.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a nurse. My dad is a real estate developer. My grandmother was, she cleaned hotel rooms on Miami Beach. My grandfather was a cab driver. So it's definitely one of those stories where like you started from the bottom and then people started moving up and up and up. But like specifically, it was in my childhood that I got into photography. So I was 12 years old and my mom didn't want me to go to the neighborhood school for middle school. And so she heard about this art school that was about an hour away in a more affluent community. And she was like, well, baby, I'm going to go to Walgreens and get a camera and then you go outside and you figure it out, right? Mm. So I'm walking around Little Haiti with a disposable camera. And luckily, since I grew up there, you know, like I was walking into the mom and pop shops, the dudes on the corner that's playing dominoes and spades, my older cousins that was doing what they were doing, and was just able to make these photographs.
Mm.
And because specifically this school had never seen Black immigrant communities documented that way. And I was a baby, right? And I didn't know how to put a portfolio together. So I came with like my little rinky dink envelope from Walgreens, from where the pictures got developed.
Still got the film strips in there.
All that, right? All that. So they had never seen anything like that. And so I get accepted to the school on the spot. And my teacher at the time gifts me a Leica.
Oh,
because
snap.
Yeah, exactly. But mind you, right? Like I'm a kid from Little Haiti. I don't know what the Leica is.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay, cool. I got a camera.
Wow.
Because at the time my mom was putting herself through nursing school. So like, I didn't really know how we were going to get the equipment for that. And my first camera was a Leica and it was photographing in Little Haiti that got me started.
So that's amazing. Big shout out to moms for having the foresight to like say, hey, you're not staying local. You're getting out of here, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm interested, right? Especially since you're a child of immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, we hear this story all the time. Folks leave wherever country they're at to get to the mm-hmm. U.S., like, you know, a lot of times like scratching their way here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because opportunities here are a lot more abundant than where they're coming from. And a lot of parents, especially Caribbean, are like, no, you need to become a doctor because your mom, right?
A lawyer.
Exactly. a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer. You're not going to just like BS this
facts.
Opportunity, right?
Facts. Yeah.
And art for a lot of people, even you know, quote unquote, successful, whatever, whatever field outside of the arts, still doesn't see art as, you know, a respected career path. So what in your mother said, I'm going to get this little girl a camera and let her go out and do whatever it is she needs to do with this camera? Like, what's going on in your mom's head that believed that this is something, a viable path for you?
Yeah. So, like, you know, I love my mom. She's still very much a Caribbean mom, right? And so, like, she just knew this as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But she didn't really know how far it could go, to be honest. My mother also is, like, very artistic herself. She loves ballet and dance and all those things. But because she came to America, she just didn't see how she could pursue those things, right?
Yeah.
But, like, she still, like, after I started, I picked up the camera. When it came to college, my mom was definitely like, well, baby, you're going to become a nursing major and you're going to become a nurse and all these other things, right? Because she was like, okay, now you're a grown up. And so you can imagine when I told my mom that, no, I'm going to major in English literature, right? Like, she flipped out. She was like, what do you mean? How are you going to get a job? But, like, at the time, I knew that literature would be instrumental in shaping an artistic practice, right? Like, you have to read. You have to engage in, like, self-reflection and introspection, I think, in order to be a prolific artist. So I became a teacher. I was a principal. I joined the military. I did all of these things. And then after I got out of the Army, though, I was like, Ma, I want to pick the camera back up. And interestingly enough, she was just like, do it. Like, if that's what you want, go ahead and do it. And I think it's because she saw that I had done everything by society standards that is deemed to be successful. Mm-hmm. But still, I couldn't shake this thing, this need to, like, make photographs.
Yeah.
And so, like, my mom is one of my biggest fans. But I will say this, though, like, my mom didn't realize how many opportunities existed in the photography space until 2020, when things blew up. And then specifically, you know, her being a Caribbean Islander, when I went to go photograph for Gucci, she was just like, so now she calling all my aunties, right? And showing off to say that, you know, her baby out there in Italy making pictures.
Oh, you went to Italy to do that?
Yeah. Oh. I shot their Aria collection.
Beautiful. So that's okay. So there's layers to you. Okay. And that's great because, you know, your work is very much about the Black experience. Everything on your portfolio, and I'm not sure if you have different portfolios for different reasons, right? But the one I'm on now, VanessaSharlow.com, is 7 projects. They're all Black centric, and a documentary, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, with documentary work, it's very personal. Because there's nobody out there telling you when to go and how long you need to focus on it, right? But to hear that you went to Italy to photograph a project for Gucci, and I'm looking at the body of work that you do, it's like, well, how did you make that crossover? Because there are people who work, like, who've been working, trying to get into the commercial game for a long time. That's all they focus on, and they still can't. And you still can't get that break. But you just being true to yourself and your personal vision were able to manifest something like that. So what happened? How were you able to, like, land that gig with Gucci?
I got an email one day from the creative director saying that she loves my documentary style. Mm-hmm. And so she would like for me to apply that to shooting the Aria collection. And so you know, at first I thought it was a joke, right? Like I couldn't believe it. And then like she sent a follow-up email and she was very gracious. And I was like, sure. And she was like, just do what you do. However you photograph, do that and just apply it to high fashion. So I remember being out there and they had us all at the end of the runway. And, you know, we were shooting the runway, but I knew that like I didn't really care for the runway. Right. Like that's not one. Even, like I know that I have a personality of a woman that's at least 5'8". In actuality, I'm 5'1" on a good day. Right.
Depending on the shoes.
Right. The shoes, if the sun is shining, you know, there's always.
I have my hair in the afro.
Exactly. So, you know, like the runway wasn't my thing. And so then I was given the opportunity to shoot on the set and shoot behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And so that's where I really flourished because I just applied that documentary lens, looking for moments, looking for genuine moments where you have models laughing or smiling or posing with like the beautiful garment without them realizing that they were posing.
Yep.
And so that's what I did with that. And they ended up loving it. And it went really well.
Yeah, because that's a different perspective. You know, like I've been called to do some like New York Fashion Week a few times in the last 2-3 years. And in my mind, I'm like, why y'all calling me to do this? Right. Mm-hmm. Like nowhere in my work do I show an interest in fashion. Right.
Right.
But it's the documentarian in me that they were looking for. And I always felt like backstage was more interesting than front of stage. I feel like if we've seen like one high quality show, we've seen them all, right? There's differences, there's variations, of course, right? But you know, we can appreciate the big performance and it's like, yeah, cool. And we're excited for that, but how many times do we actually get to see, like, say, like a Beyonce rehearsing, you know,
right.
Like, and tired and sweatpants, eating fried chicken and fingers are greasy, right? you don't get to see that, right? But if you're able to, like, be back there and getting, like, these models who, like, supermodels, everybody knows their face from all over the world, but you're able to get them in, like, these... I don't want to say vulnerable, but in these just real candid moments where they kind of forget that the camera's on. Because when the camera's on, they do all of the duck lips and they do all of this, like all this stuff for the camera. But it's like, when is your face regular?
Right. Just honest moments.
Exactly.
Honest moments.
Wow.
And like also during my time there, I met a brilliant fashion photographer named Tommy Tan. And Tommy is highly known in the fashion world. And so, like, he was just another cool brother that was just like, look, just do you, right? And because exactly what you're talking about, I prefer candid moments. I prefer honest moments. Again, like, that's what made that shoot quite memorable for me.
Yeah, wow. Congrats on that. That's dope.
Thank you.
Yeah, so... you're welcome. So, you know, looking at your work, you know, your work focuses on the black body, right? And you give agency and humanity to our people, you know. Growing up in Little Haiti, right, and having experiences that you did have out there, like, what experiences led you to focus on this with your camera?
Well, you know, when you think about the rhetoric and the narrative around immigrants in the 80s, particularly Haitians, was that we were boat people, right? There was also a conversation about us carrying diseases with us, that all of us were poor. So even conceiving the fact that some of us were actually professional in our own countries was not really a part of the conversation.
That's right.
And so, like, I just remember listening to my elders have conversations around the kitchen table, right, about the harassment or what have you. And then So I'm aware of them being or experiencing what they're experiencing. And then on the flip side, Sunday morning, grandma and them, who's a maid, is dressed to the gods, mm-hmm. right, to go to church.
Yeah.
Or like my older cousins who, for all intents and purposes, were hood dudes. And so when you see them on the block, and, you know, there's a very specific Miami aesthetic, which is locks, grills, and tats, right? Like, that's very much the Miami look. And so they have, like, these preconceived ideas that are being imposed on them. But then I know these dudes. Like, these are the dudes that tuck me in when my mom is at work, right? Or read me bedtimes. Like, I know them intimately. And so I knew that I wanted to dispel, like, these preconceived notions around Black bodies with the camera. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, like, when you look at pictures from, like, the early 1900s or late 1800s, unless you have prolific people like James Van Der Zee who are making these pictures, Black folk were typically in a position of subjugation, mm-hmm. right? So we were enslaved, we were sitting on the floor, we were the mammies, we were sitting in the back. And so, like, that reinforces this idea that, like, we're less than. And so I just knew that going to this school that was a predominantly white school and studying the work that they were showing to me, it did not match my actual life. Like, there was a huge disconnect there, right? Because the women that I had in my life were very proud women. The men that I had in my life were hardworking men. So I didn't really understand this this destitute story that was being told. And so I just began to photograph what was around me. And even though there were parts of that reality that existed, I just wanted to make it more nuanced. The other thing is that when you think about, like I shared with you that I'm big on literature, when you think about the work of, like, let's say Toni Morrison or Chinua Achebe or different people like that, our lives don't exist in juxtaposition to the white culture. Like, oftentimes people try to use a dominant culture as the standard,
as a right? As point, if, right?
Exactly. And it's just like, and I love when Toni Morrison, the late great Toni Morrison, said this, like, when you do that, it is as if our lives have no meaning, have no depth outside of the white gates.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that really informed my work, my upbringing, and also just like the kind of people that I've been studying and reading over the years.
What's up, family? If you're enjoying this episode, do us a solid by leaving us a 5-star rating or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Play. We appreciate the support. So on that note, we're going to get back into the show. Peace. So that's really, that's okay. So that's dope, right? Because I've always said, and I've said this on several different conversations, that when someone has an interest outside of photography and then mm-hmm. they merge that interest with photography, it gives them a very unique perspective that nobody can, it's very difficult to do for anybody to duplicate or replicate that, because you're bringing two of your different passions together, right? And
right.
And you know, you study literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, and you could correct me if I'm off base, but like your love and appreciation for literature is that passion that you fuse with your photography. So it's almost like a history lesson in a photo or in a photo project, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Like I'm literally having like a poetical conversation with light.
Yes.
Right? When it comes to making photography, like it's something that is actually very thought out. And it may, like, I want to have a conversation with the audience, and I want to have a conversation that supersedes that, okay, this is a powerful photograph. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Because there's these coin phrases that people like to use, like it's powerful, it's strong. Why are you saying that? And let's go deeper into that, mm-hmm. right? Like let's explore really like what it means to be human in a Black form in this space. And what about this photograph makes you uncomfortable as well, right? Like, so there's a saying that good art is supposed to disturb. Mm. And like, I think that's important too. I want that, like if I make a photograph or a portrait of someone, I want this Black face to take up the entire frame sometimes. And that is intentional,
yeah.
right? Like I want you to think about or reimagine Black folk taking up space. So like when it comes to my work, I'm always deeply moved when people from all kinds of demographics appreciate my work. Like I love that. And I'm so grateful for that. But first things first, like I'm having a conversation with us.
Yeah.
This is a private conversation. And I want you to look at yourself through this subject and examine yourself through their eyes.
So that's really beautiful. Yesterday I was having a conversation with my wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me about, you know, her upbringing with, you know, my wife is from Dominican Republic. So kind of understand, the Haiti Dominican, relationship to use okay. a very interesting word, relationship.
That's
right?
that's politically correct. Okay.
You know, with all the complexities involved in that, right? But you know, she was saying how there was this photo of her and her twin sister when they were like 4 years old coming to the United States, and she was like, at that age, she was like, they always had a blank stare. Her and her sister always had a blank stare because they were just like shocked or whatever, right? I was like,
mm-hmm.
I was like, but you don't always trust the photo. You know, I said, the photo is a lie.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. It's that there's three things that happen with a photo, right? Is what actually happened, is what the photographer documented, and then it's what mm-hmm. how the viewer interprets that.
Right.
Right. So basically, as the photographer, right, you are in that moment experiencing what your life experiences have led you to experience in that moment. So you're going to press the shutter at a moment where it makes sense for you, because mm-hmm. you also know that you want us, you know, your core audience, Black folks, you want us to feel something,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we see this image, but then we choose to see it however we want to see it, right? So I just wanted to bring that point up because we're talking about poetry and how like the photo can communicate different things, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that, like about like what a photo actually represents.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's multiple conversations happening at once, right? So there's a conversation that the subject is having with the camera and the photographer simultaneously.
Yes.
And then there's a conversation that the photographer is having with the subject. And so after that's produced, then there's a conversation that is had between the photographer and the audience, and then the audience amongst itself.
Yes.
So like there's various layers, and you're right. Like I may have a specific intention behind the work, but I do think that our personal experiences really shape how we understand photography or this artistic practice. Because we're all coming from like different angles, right? And different ways of understanding what we see. And so like, I may take a specific picture that solicits a kind of emotion from me, and you may see that same picture and it solicits something very different. Mm-hmm. Or like even think about when we go, like when folks go on photo walks, y'all can walk down the same street and it can be five of you all and you all take five different pictures.
Yep.
So that's just, I mean, I think that that's just the reality of it, right? Like that's why I think that photography is so powerful, because it's such a democratic process. Like you get to you get to freely choose how you want to engage with the work.
Absolutely. So as a professor, what conversations do you have with your with the students about how they make work and how they view work?
Yeah. So, you know, before I came here to the University of Mississippi, I've been teaching at ICP for some time.
In New York?
And yeah.
You were in person or virtually? Okay, cool.
No, virtually. Yeah. So I taught intersectionality in documentary photography and ethics in photography. And I think that I could be biased, right? But I think that when you're thinking about like intersectionality in photography, those are conversations that really are the basis of the work, in my opinion. So like when you're thinking about how does the female body show up in spaces, right? What is the gaze? What does it mean to render someone visible or invisible? How does composition impact our understanding of the subject? Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of theoretical things. And these are the kinds of conversations that I'm having with my students for two reasons. I think that it's lazy for someone to just be like, I just like it. And I took the photograph, especially if you're a thinking and working photographer.
Yeah.
Right. Like there has to be a lot more than just, this was pretty. And that may just be it. But if you want to have a real conversation around your work, then I think that you have to add some level of depth to it. Now, in New York, it was very easy to have this conversation. Here in Mississippi, I have to have the conversation a little bit more delicately, right? Because the current political climate may make some students feel uncomfortable about what I'm asking them to do and asking them to think about. But a lot of it is conversations that are based on the abstract. And I hope that like those abstract ideas, you're able to crystallize it in a photograph. But it's difficult conversations for sure, right? And so they're definitely challenged because I'm bringing up the work of like Chester Higgins or Jean Mutasami Ash, and looking at that within the context of like, let's say James Baldwin, Many Thousands Gone. Right. Or Susan Sontag, her essay on photography, and having them really think about the role that the camera plays. And I think that for the longest time, many photographers and I would say specifically student photographers don't understand that like their camera is a tool of power. Mm-hmm. So when you're wielding this power, are you being responsible with it?
Or even being conscious that you even have this tool, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, are you aware of what you're doing? Because, like, what happens when you make a photograph and the subject may, for example, never feel comfortable to walk into the gallery? So you'll never hear their story. Mm. So, like, there's a level of power that you're wielding here. And what are you going to do with that?
Well, that's great. You know, I definitely felt like I didn't understand how much power was in that shutter click.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a simple, I mean, if you think about it, you know, sometimes, depending on what you're photographing, that 1/1000th of a second, right? It's so much power in that fraction of a second that we choose to like press that button, you know, and we don't always know what the response is going to be. And for me, it was always when I really stopped taking pictures of buildings and architecture and clouds. When I was just learning my camera because I was afraid to photograph people. When I stopped doing that and I started finding more of a purpose, I realized that I was aiming to make our folks look powerful. And I knew that there were some photos that I may have decided not to take that might have told a more well-rounded story at the time, but I didn't want to show like us in like some sort of sadness or despair. And I chose not to make those images, or I chose not to share those images, right? I may have them, but I just chose not to share them. You know, and instead decided to make a make a project where we just felt like regal and royal from one image to the next. That's a very, very personal choice. And it could be, and some, I guess some ethics people might find that unethical, because it's like, well, where's the balance in the story? But as the person behind the camera in control of the finger that controls the button, I said, I'm not putting those photos out there, right? Because we've seen too many photos of us in despair, you know?
Absolutely.
And I made a conscious decision to not share images like that, or not share projects that are based on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, hearing you share that makes me think of the work Jamel Shabazz, right?
Yeah.
And he's so intense. Like, you clearly know what the story or the message that he's conveying. It's about culture. It's about community. It's about beautiful Black life. And you can see, like, in the environment that there are things happening.
Yeah.
It is still New York during a specific time. So he doesn't render that invisible, but, like, he allows for, like, Black people to be, like, full human beings that just don't have these sad stories all the time. And, like, I don't find that to be unethical at all. Like, again, I think that to regenerate the same stereotypical ideas about people, irrespective of race or gender or whatever, like, where's the creativity in that? Mm. And then that means that, like, you know, like, there was, to me, like, there was no real deep thought, because it is too easy. You go, like, let's say San Francisco, and you go photograph the homeless. Okay. And there may be things that are deeply striking about that. Okay, but what else, right? Like, this person, they may be experiencing homelessness, and that's a part of their reality, but there's so much more to them than just that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So looking at, looking at the fullness.
Beneath the surface, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So,
and sometimes that's hard to do, right? Because photography is a very aesthetic thing. Like, it's very visual. And sometimes it can definitely appear as, like, the single layered concept.
Well, yeah, that's why, like, a lot of the most powerful work is an ongoing project where you spend time developing it, developing your voice. And if it's focused on, like, a singular person or a group of people, then you get to know them better through photos and spend the time with them, and they get more comfortable with you being there with your camera, and they trust you that you're not exploiting them, right? And then you're able to get real, genuine, honest access to tell their story. But if you stop at the image of them looking, you know, in despair, hungry and homeless with a blanket over them, and you just keep it moving, you know, that feels a little bit predatory. You know, it's like, or you dehumanize people. And I've done that. I've done that in the beginning. I've done that as a tourist, where I may not have understood what it is that I was photographing, and it was just the voyeuristic approach. And I've had to learn how to recognize when I was being voyeuristic as opposed to being curious. And I think that's, again, that goes with experience in this craft. It's like learning how to see without the camera.
Yes. Same. Like, I remember from 2012 to, like, 2019, I lived off and on in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, right? And so initially, I was making pictures in Haiti and completely voyeuristic. To be completely honest, like, it was very voyeuristic. I didn't really understand what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I had such a sobering moment, Idris. I happened to be in my yard with my son, right? And my son is definitely like this. He's like a boy's boy. Like, he likes being outdoors. He gets dirty. He likes sports and all that other stuff. And so my son is in the yard. and this boy is filthy. I mean, like, really?
Yeah, it's
a hot mess, right? And Jacob is in raw form. Like, he's having a field day, right? And I thought to myself, like, okay, we're in the mountains of Haiti. We have a nice little situation, whatever, whatever. What if someone photographed my son right now? Devoid of context.
Mm-hmm.
In Haiti. So what you're going to see is probably a dirty little poor black boy. Because you may not take a picture of his environment. You're just going to take a portrait of him. And you may say that he looks cool right now because he has mud on him and all this other stuff. And then what kind of story does that create?
Mm.
And like, I had to sit with that, right? And I had to go through my archives and think about what photographs have I made that if it was my son or my loved one being photographed in a specific kind of way, devoid of context, that would really irk my nerves. And so like that became like the litmus test for me. Like if it was my mama, right? Let's say mama just rolled out of bed. She got rollers in her hair, all that stuff. She doesn't look her best. Is that when I want mama to be photographed? Yeah. Unless she's comfortable with it, right? If she's comfortable with it, cool. But if she's not, then, you know, like exactly what you're saying, there's a level of like, there's a predatory nature in that. And we got to sit with that as photographers. Like, it's hard, but we have to be honest with ourselves.
Man, one of the best pieces of feedback I've received was when I lived in Ghana. It was this photographer out there, Francis Kokoroko, and I met up with him for the first time out there and sharing work with each other. And I shared some photos that I had just made while I was in Ghana. I had only been there maybe 2 weeks. And he was like, I have to be honest, man, you're photographing us like a tourist. And I think as a, you know, up and coming photographer, I was like going at this, trying to make this my profession. Nobody wants to, like, no photographer wants to hear that you're photographing like a tourist. Cause then I imagine all these like lost people in Times Square with their flash on, taking pictures of like a building that's like 50 stories high and they got the flash on. Like, I think about that and being compared to that, right? And I was like, that hurt, that stung, but it meant that I was only seeing the surface level of things. I was only seeing like the caricature of the culture and not seeing like the real people. And that was very, very important. That will stay with me for the rest of my life, especially when I go outside the US, but even here, you know, learn to see people, learn to see the environment. You know, you probably got to spend some time in a place observing before you even take the camera out if you want to start to get to the heart of the experience that you're in at that moment.
No, absolutely. Because think about it too, right? Like, you can be made into a caricature too.
Oh, I'm not sure we have
all
been.
Of us can.
And we have
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right? So, like, just again, putting yourself in their place, like, it makes you just hyper aware of how you want people to show up in your frame.
You know, you pose a question in your writing, and you write very beautifully. Caption.
Thank you.
Descriptions that go along with your story. You're welcome. In one of the descriptions, you pose a question. How do black women cope with the alienation and anguish of their experience? And one thing that I ask a lot of guests who cover deeply emotional work, and I get a sense of deep emotion in the projects that you photograph. That's just my experience with them. But, you know, how do you heal and recover from documenting the kinds of stories that you document? Like, how do you cope?
Oh, man. That's good. I'm going to keep it a buck with you. I don't always cope well. Because it is deep emotional work, right? Like, this is like soul work. This is spirit work for me. And so like, it is difficult for me to separate myself from the subject. Like, it's not just another person that I'm photographing, right? Like, it is someone who has probably experienced things that I know quite intimately. And I'm not at all encouraging photographers to take my approach in terms of being so emotionally invested in the work. I hope that you do give a damn, but it's hard because just because you finish a project or a story, that doesn't mean that it's done with you. And so, like, you do have to sit there and deal with that. And so on the days where I am able to look at the work without allowing myself to go there emotionally, I definitely engage in, like, self-care practices, right? Like, I'm definitely jamming out. And like, my musical taste varies. So, like, I can go from, like, trap music, like Trick Daddy Dollar, to Miles Davis.
Miami in the building.
Very Miami, right? To like Miles Davis or Etta Fitzgerald, right? So I use that to kind of like ease what I'm looking at. But I do think that when you engage in this practice and you choose to document the stories of people who look like you, you begin to unveil things about yourself that are sometimes hard to look at. Because, like, a lot of us are living from a position of survival. Mm. And so we're just trying to get through it. And I think that, you know, like, when you're a photographer and you're revisiting your work, like, these are real emotions that come up. And you have to have your own way of processing that and dealing with that. I can't say that I have a concrete way to do it, to be honest, because I'm so attached to the work that I do. But I do try to, in terms of a coping mechanism, like, just try to be really, really grateful that folks trust me enough to share pieces of themselves with me photographically.
I mean, yeah, attitude of gratitude goes a very long way.
Oh, know? Yeah, for sure. Because, like, nobody has to let you.
Yeah.
Like, they can straight up tell you no. And yeah, they're entitled.
Absolutely.
They're entitled. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, they gifting you with something, you know, and you have to be humbled by that and appreciative of that.
Yeah, I do hope that you continue your self-care practice, whatever it is that you do. That allows you to continuously go out there and make work that is way beneath the surface. You know, yeah, I kind of straddle the fence between, like, wanting to do documentary work about things that are important to me, that are meaningful, but also wanting to do some commercial work that, you know, is fun and light and entertaining and can make a lot of money, you know?
Right. Ain't nothing wrong with that.
Oh. Yeah, it's not wrong.
Get to the bag. Right? Get to the bag.
You know?
But, absolutely.
With that being said, like, who were you before you declared yourself a photographer? Because 2018, 19 sounds like you started really getting the ball rolling, right? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, who was Vanessa as you were leading up to that point where you said, I'm a photographer. I'm going out there. I'm gonna make this camera work for me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I never really put the camera down, even when I was in the military or living in various places. But I wasn't like I'm gonna get published, and, you know, like, until around 2017, 18. That's when I became a lot more intentional about that. But who was I before that? I was definitely somebody's mama. Mm-hmm. I was also, like, someone who was, like, seeking and seeking greater understanding of myself. So I spent time in Southeast Asia.
With your son?
Yeah, with my son.
Beautiful.
Making pictures and studying Buddhism. and Hindu and things like that. So I did that. I've always been like in the field of education and teaching. So I was teaching in Haiti as well. And I was, who was I? That is such a good question. I was just someone that was like allowing life to unfold itself to me and not trying to force anything. And that's something that I still apply to my life now, where I just allow things to flow and then manifest how it will, and trust that whatever's for me is for me. But that took a lot of time, right? And a lot of like self-discipline and consecration in order to do that.
Yeah, you know, it takes a lot of trust to also just let things unfold around you without trying to control it too much, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. Because like, you know what, like control is such a false idea.
Oh.
Right? Like we really have no control or nothing.
Nothing.
We just in this thing.
Except ourselves.
Hoping for the best.
We have control over ourselves, how we think about something, how we respond, how we react. We have control over our emotions, whether things happen for us or don't happen for us, right? That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
And even then, like just to provide some nuance, even that has some falsity to it, right? Because you have no control whether or not you're going to take the next breath.
Mm. Okay.
Or whether or not you're going to make your heart beat.
Yep.
And those are fundamental things to keep your behind alive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So really, really, we're just in this thing. And you can train yourself or condition yourself to respond or not respond to things that are coming into your awareness or what have you. But really, you know, like those things are out of our control as well. And so like just accepting that, like for example, when it comes to this photography thing, I love it. I don't force it, right? Like if someone feels the work, they feel the work. If they don't, that's okay. That was not for you or that was not for you to consume or what have you. But that took time in terms of building myself to who I am now, but I'm still definitely on that journey. And I think that photography just gives me like an avenue to perfect myself as a human being first, and then hopefully have that translate into my practice. This is Vanessa Charlot, and you are tuned in to the Black Shutter Podcast.
I want to give a big shout out to everyone who tuned into this episode. Thank you for listening. The Black Shutter Podcast is hosted by me, Idris Talib Solomon. To subscribe to the Black Shutter Podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. When you get there, show us some love by dropping a 5-star rating or leaving a review. This will help with our rankings, which essentially helps more Black photographers get exposure. Make sure to check us out online at blackshutterpodcast.com to read the show notes, learn more about our guests, and check out some of their work. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Peace. Until next time.